Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. On today's Homefront, we're interviewing Phyllis Schlafly, who is a constitutional lawyer, a conservative, an activist, an author, and founder of Eagle Forum. Phyllis, how are you doing today?
Okay, good to talk to you.
What Phyllis is best known for is her opposition to the ERA amendment and her ability to defeat it and therefore define the future of America. So she earned a degree from Washington University in 1944 and then a master's degree in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, Phyllis, one question I have for you. Our lives have somewhat paralleled because I grew up in Illinois, and then when I was 12, we moved to Boston. And so it seems like we kind of followed the same path, and then I got to Missouri. What took you to Boston?
Well, when I finished Washington University, I wanted to go to Harvard and get a master's, a one-year project. And so I applied. They accepted me. And I've spent a very happy year in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Special. That's very special. Although my memories of Massachusetts were very different. Maybe it was by the time I got there so liberal, but I remember going back for a wedding for a friend of ours, and during the reception, somebody tiptoed up to me and whispered in my ear, "I'm a Republican also."
Oh.
And it was funny because the entire time I lived there, I never knew a Republican, and it just seems like it has gone so far to the left that having you go there to get a degree just should inspire all the other...
Well, of course, it was not that left-wing when I was there. I will say that most of them were, as we say, New Dealers, supporters of Franklin Roosevelt. My family never was. As a matter of fact, my father used to say that our family left the Democratic Party in the Depression of Grover Cleveland. And that's so far before your time, you probably don't even... In fact, I said when I say that for young people, they don't even know who Grover Cleveland is. It was in the last century. And so I was not a Roosevelt backer at any time, but most of the professors that I dealt with at Harvard were.
So what inspired you to get your law degree at Washington University?
Well, now, that was much later. I was grown, married, and had children. And I was fighting the battle of the Equal Rights Amendment, and that is a constitutional issue. And I was debating these left-wing feminist lawyers, and they were kind of twitting me because I wasn't a lawyer. So I applied and went to Washington University Law School after I was 50 and took the full course and graduated.
I know what you're talking about with the feminist lawyers because I spent 8 years in the Missouri State Legislature, and the women lawyers used to like to get together with us, and there were very few of, I don't believe I ever actually met one woman lawyer who was also a conservative.
Yeah, that's right. They were mostly feminists. Of course, feminism teaches women when you wake up in the morning that you are a victim of the patriarchy, and they want to abolish the patriarchy. And, of course, if that's your attitude toward life, you're probably not going to be happy, and you're not going to accomplish anything in life, but that's the way they are.
Well, you know, we're not going to change the world or make it a better place for anybody if we don't engage in the process. And you did so much. You wrote a book, and what's interesting about your book is you self-published before the self-publishing was popular. What made you decide to print your own book instead of going through a publisher?
Well, you're talking about my first book, A Choice Not an Echo, which I did in 1964. And one of my hobbies in life has been the Republican National Conventions. I've been to every one since 1952, and I watched how the establishment would simply take over and get their candidate in instead of the people, instead of the candidate the grassroots wanted. And that was a year when we were all pushing for Barry Goldwater to be a real conservative nominated by the Republican Party. And I knew how the establishment had stolen the nomination from Robert Taft in 1952, and most everybody, you know, there are a couple of thousand delegates to every Republican National Convention, and I would say nearly all of them, most of them, are first-timers. So they had no idea, really, what was like, what was going to happen, and what went before. And I wrote A Choice Not an Echo to tell them what happened at previous conventions to be prepared. And here I am, a housewife with six children, and who's going to publish a book by somebody who's never published anything before? Well, you know, in those days, it took a book about 2 years to get from being submitted to the time it was actually released. And so I just plunged. I found a fast printer of paperback books, and I plunged with ordering a 25,000 in order to make sure I had enough to go to all the delegates to the Republican National Convention in 1964, so in order to help the candidacy of Barry Goldwater, and ended up selling 3 million out of my garage.
That's amazing. What really is great about that story is that we can make a difference whether we're in office or not. And at the time you'd written that book, you had not won a public office yourself. You lost your congressional race in 1952. Then you lost the National Federation of Republican Women presidency race in 1967. Then you lost your bid for Congress in 1970. And yet, having never held a public office, people know your name and your legacy and your accomplishments far more than we can name and even a dozen Congress people during that time. So what do you think is something that people can do to be successful even if they don't win an election?
Well, I think, my story is a good example of how somebody who's not a public official can make a difference. And I'll tell you that, you know, there are people coming through to our headquarters in St. Louis all the time writing their Ph.D. dissertations on how the Equal Rights Amendment was defeated and the whole history of the conservative movement. And so it's interesting to find out and realize what happens. And I think what I did with this book, it wasn't just to nominate Barry Goldwater, but it really created the conservative movement. And it showed the grassroots that they can override the establishment. Now, the establishment, the big money people in those days, in the 1960s, was headquartered in the Chase Manhattan Bank. They were a bunch of New York bankers who thought they knew more than anybody else and were globalists and wanted their kind of candidate. And now it's a lot of big money people. Karl Rove is the one who's handled hundreds of millions of dollars of their donations. And they only want candidates who will do what they're told. That's the most important thing. And they want them to not talk about the social or the moral issues or even the way that U.S. jobs are shipped overseas or even the national defense issues. They want them to stick to just some economic issues and act like the Democrats.
Well, and that's what we're going to get. If we want to act like the Democrats to get elected, then why is it any...
We call them Me Too candidates.
Right. There are people who are the kingmakers. I believe you were the one who coined that word. We didn't understand what a kingmaker was until we saw that there are some people who are using the elected officials as puppets. They are the ones behind the elected officials and calling out the agenda.
Now, just look what happened in Texas in the last round. The establishment was for a very wealthy man who had been elected and reelected, was extremely popular, had buco money of his own, and he was expected to win the race, the nomination for Senate, and then Texas is a Republican state, so then he'd go on to be a U.S. Senator. Well, the grassroots decided they wanted Ted Cruz. And when he started out, when Eagle Forum sent our first contribution to him, he was only 2% in the polls. But he worked hard, and people saw there was a difference. And they wanted the grassroots to make the selection, not the establishment. And so he slowly gathered strength, and he ended up winning the primary and then going on to be elected U.S. Senator from Texas. And he's one of the best people down there. And he's not one to just take orders from the establishment. And it's such a wonderful illustration of how if you go into the Republican primary and work for a good candidate and you get your guy on the ballot, then he has a chance to win.
Yeah, that's true, although it didn't happen with Todd Akin.
No, it didn't. The establishment treated him just unbelievably mean and despicable.
Yeah.
But he did make one mistake. I do think our candidates ought to be more careful in what they say, and they need a little coaching in how to handle some of these difficult subjects when the media are trying to create a trap for them to fall into. But nevertheless, as it came down the wire, what Karl Rove said about him was absolutely unacceptable. And the establishment wanted the Democrat, Claire McCaskill, to win. That's how bitter and nasty they were.
Yeah, bitter and nasty is right. I was very disappointed because Todd Akin didn't lose because of the Democrats. He lost because of the Republicans. In this case, they would rather give the seat to a Senate seat to a Democrat than see a conservative Republican like Todd Akin win it.
Yes, that's right, because they knew they couldn't tell Akin how to vote.
Very sad. So when we were talking about our interview and you said that you had a perfect marriage, and I'm inspired by that. So how do you define a perfect marriage? What actually is a perfect marriage?
Well, I don't know. Maybe mine isn't a good model for everybody else, but it was a very happy marriage. And I kind of feel the good Lord found my husband for me and sent him over, and we just had a very, very happy life.
Well, I'm happy for you, too. I remember in O'Fallon when I was running for mayor, and I had a friend who went to my church who had actually worked very hard on Todd Akin's election for a House seat. So I asked her if she would help with my campaign, and her reply was so profound and really disturbing that I saved her letter all these years. She said, really, that I should be home making nutritious meals for my husband. And many conservatives think men should run for office and women should stay at home. And I do not think running for office is for everyone. It's certainly not for people who don't have their home life together. But when I ran for office, I always did it under the direction of my husband. And he wanted me to run. Our entire family felt like they were running. And when I got elected, they felt like they got elected. And so my situation was different than many people. My husband was a great husband. But he didn't enjoy being even on the finance committee of the church. He just wanted, me to be his mouthpiece. And I think that's very special. So how do you answer the question when people ask you, why would you run for Congress if you, instead of staying home and just taking care of your husband?
Well, you have to understand I did have the support of my husband. And you know, Cynthia, the feminists have no sense of humor. And I found that I could open my speeches as I went to speak on college campuses with a little joke. And I would start out by saying, I want to thank my husband for letting me come and speak to you tonight. And you could tell who the feminists are because they're the ones not laughing. And it was truthful. I wouldn't, if he wasn't supportive, I wouldn't have done it.
Right.
And he was supportive of everything that I did. And I remember in his last days when he was not well, and shortly before he died, he said some precious words that I'll never forget. He said, you gave me everything I ever wanted. And they were all joint decisions, and he loved politics, but he realized he couldn't run for office because he had to support our family.
And that's my story exactly. If my husband had run for the House of Representatives, who would have stayed home and run the bookstore?
Yeah, that's right. Who would have made the money to bring home the bacon?
Yeah, so it was perfect. I agree. I concur. I think I had a perfect marriage, too. But anyway, it says on your Wikipedia article that you became an outspoken opponent of the Equal Rights Amendment, and you did it by saying, stop taking our privileges. And I like the way you state that, because it is really very beautiful, and it captures the essence. And it goes on to say that the ERA would take away gender-specific privileges currently enjoyed by women, including dependent wife benefits under Social Security and the exemption from the Selective Service Registration. So even though without the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, I think you and I can both agree that women have lost today a lot of privileges that we used to have. Can you name any privileges that you can think of that where women have taken a step backward from where we were a few?
Well, the two main ones that, in the first place, you understand, the Equal Rights Amendment didn't give women anything. The word women was not even in it. The word in ERA was sex. And we now know that what it really would have done would have been to put same-sex marriage in the Constitution. But in any event, they didn't. It was a big fraud because it didn't give women anything at all. But it did take away some of the benefits they had. For example, the laws of every one of the 50 states said that it was the duty and obligation of the husband to financially support his wife and children and provide her with a home. Now, that is a tremendous benefit, and it would make that gender neutral. The ERA would have made that gender neutral. Also, at that time, we had a war going on. We were fighting the Vietnam War. And the women were exempt from the draft. And I had sons and daughters about age 18 at that time. And the very first thing that would have happened would have been to gender neutralize the law, the specific law that is not gender neutral. Because the draft law has always said male citizens of age 18 must register. And my daughters at that time thought, well, you mean you're going to give us a constitutional amendment and the first thing is we have to sign up for the draft like our brothers? You got to be kidding.
Yeah, we have taken some, yeah, it's and the family courts are ruling adversely now to women. Used to be called, what, they'd get alimony, and alimony now is, then they changed the word to maintenance, and now there's pretty much, when there's a divorce, there's an assumption that you take care of yourself, lady.
Yeah, there's all things the matter. The biggest thing about the family court is that they have misdefined and changed the meaning of the traditional language the best interest of the child. And that used to mean that the parents were the best ones to decide what was in the best interest of the child. But now their view is the judge is. And so the judge has the right, the legal right, to make all decisions about child care and child custody and who sees the child and so forth, instead of parents. And that is very anti-family and very harmful to our society.
Well, you said it so beautifully in your newsletter, and I'm going to quote you. You said, many fathers work long hours and make incredible sacrifices for their families. Child support formulas are based on the ridiculous notion that a father would make the same sacrifices for an ex-wife who is living with her new husband or boyfriend and for children he never or seldom sees. And you said it so well that when you estrange men purposely from their family, and then I love what you talk about with the formula, you said a California wife under community property laws is entitled to 50% of her husband's income and 50% of her own income. But if she divorces him and gets custody of their two kids, then she gets 40% of his income plus 100% of her income. So where's the fairness in that?
No, there's no fairness in it, and it's all in the judge's discretion. And the judge's decisions practically never get appealed because most people haven't got the money to appeal. And anyway, the judge is entitled to use his own discretion, which means his own bias, and so it's very difficult to get any of these mistakes overruled.
Yeah, well, we're looking at the entire whole world falling apart. Part of the problem is that people are faced with moral issues they're afraid to talk about, and the legislators are not finding good answers. I remember when I was in the Missouri House that there were a majority of the women in office are Democrats, and they feel like it's their duty to beat up on the men because they're all so bad, but that this gang mentality is not serving us well, nor is it reasonable. So let me tell you what you missed out on by not going to Congress. The women legislators occasionally go on special trips that are just exclusively for women. Now, if the men tried doing this, the women would be pounding down the doors to get invited, but for some reason the women can have their own events, and that's okay. But I always felt uncomfortable when, usually dominated by very left-leaning, pro-lesbian, men-mocking, feminist women that really had a different agenda than just being women in government. In fact, you mentioned the Vietnam War that was going on, and at the last Women in Government conference I went to, they had one of the speakers was Jane Fonda. How special is that?
Yeah.
So my question is, when we look at the future of where our country is headed, we need to ask ourselves the serious questions, and I'd like to ask you, what do you envision for where we're going now? I don't know how much hope or reason for hope we have when you look at what happened to Todd Akin and Ed Martin, Jim Lemke, Shane Scholer, when the question is on the ballot about human cloning or gambling or homosexuality. We're getting beaten every time. We're not seeing too many victories. I mean, I love your story about Texas, but we need something else bigger than one person out of 535 in Congress. Or even if we could find a dozen good people in Congress, that's not going to be enough to do it. I mean, the reason Obamacare passed is because the majority of the American voters in America sent candidates to Congress who wanted bigger government, more intrusive government, and more expensive government. So what is our proper response?
Well, there are more than you think. There are really some very good people in Congress, and they're working hard. People like Michelle Bachmann and Steve King and a lot of others who are in Congress trying to do what they can. And the game of the game is to get more of them. And we have an election coming up next year. The important thing for conservatives to do is to go into the primaries and elect the conservative candidate who'll go down there and to Congress and represent us. And we have had quite a number of victories. I understand they just signed a very good law in North Carolina, which really tightens up the laws about elections, so they can't have much fraud, and as they've had before. And we have a majority of Republican state legislatures. They ought to get busy and pass some more good laws. And so I'm optimistic that we've got another chance. We really blew the chance last year. And I just wrote an article in my column this week praising Dr. Jerry Corsi's new book, which is called What Went Wrong. And he explains why, in spite of having all the odds on the side of the Republican, and nevertheless, the Republicans lost. And so we're just going to have to be smarter and realize we have to get the right candidates on the ballot.
Do you think these races, especially on the higher level, are pretty much determined by whoever has the most money?
Well, in the Ted Cruz race in Texas, it was the guy he beat was a tremendously wealthy man who had more money. And money certainly is important. But just look at what happened, and Jerry Corsi tells this very well in his new book, What Went Wrong. But Karl Rove had the big donor money, and he had control of something like $400 million, which he put into races for Congress and to the Senate, and he lost most of them.
Wow.
Just consider that. He spent all that money and lost most of the races he was involved in.
It's a good thing he didn't go to the horse track.
Yeah. Right. And so money's important, no question about it. But the big donors, unfortunately, give a lot of their money to the wrong people.
Well, and I'd like to ask you a few questions about education, because you are an expert on what we're doing to educate our children. The concern I have is, even with a majority of Republicans, it seems like we still get stuck with No Child Left Behind, Common Core, Race to the Top, name anything you want. It is all about growing government bigger. And I was so surprised to read that even the Republican platform calls for more funding for Head Start. Can you help me understand how let me tell you, as a former Republican legislator, I'll tell you exactly what's going on. The committee, when we meet as a caucus, they say, well, you have to be pro-education, which means pro-education funding, which means more money for all these programs if you're going to get elected, because that's the winning message. That is what the voters want to hear. If you say everything's for the children, you win. Or if you say anything against funding for education, you will get painted as anti-child, and then you'll definitely lose. How can we overcome this stigma?
Well, you ought to read more of the Phyllis Schlafly report in regard to Head Start. Even their own evaluations have shown that basically it's a waste of money. An enormous amount of money has been put into Head Start, and they've tracked the progress of these kids who've been through it, and it showed a little progress academically for a year or so. And then it fades away by the second or third grade. It's all gone. And their other behavioral problems that got worse because they were in Head Start. So their own evaluations tell us that. But beyond that, I want to give you a word of encouragement. Is about this new national education policy called Common Core. And this is an attempt to impose standards nationally on all children called the Common Core Standards. And a national plan is a bad idea. And, of course, this means that Arne Duncan and the Obama people get control of it, so they will control what kids learn and what they do not learn, which is just as important. And the encouraging thing is the way Common Core has stirred up the grassroots. I cannot believe it. I heard there was going to be a meeting at the Chesterfield City Hall a few weeks ago, and I thought, well, I'll go out and see that. I got out there when it was time to start at 7 o'clock. There were already 300 people sitting in straight chairs to listen to the program, and another 100 came in over the evening. Most of them had to sit on the floor. And these are parents, young parents, who aren't really knowledgeable about what went before, but who suddenly realize that the Obama government is trying to take over what our children are learning, and they're not happy about it, and they're all stirred up. And I think this is at our Eagle Council that we have our national, I think our 42nd annual meeting of our leadership of Eagle Forum in September. We're going to devote a whole morning to giving people the all the information they need to know about Common Core so they can go back and fight it in their states.
And I did read your Eagle Forum report on Common Core. It sounds like you're saying that it might make the kids in the middle go up a notch. The children who are on the upper end of intelligence, it's going to dumb them down, and it will do nothing for the children on the bottom. Is that about a quick summary?
That's right. I just... It is as working for the Lake Wobegon effect, where all children are the men are strong and the women are beautiful and all children are above average.
Well, we're going to have to continue telling the truth. I think my biggest disappointment is we wouldn't even have these programs if they didn't get so much support from the Republican legislators. Even in Missouri, we're trying to bring some sense. I asked them when I was there, how is it possible that there's nobody in our entire state who's smart enough to know how to educate our children, that we have to look to Washington, D.C. and let them tell us how to teach our children?
Well, that's a good question, and some of the people who've evaluated these Common Core standards say they're inferior to most of the states, that there are about 12 states that have standards that are significantly better. So if you're trying to improve the standards of your state, you might look to the programs of one or more of those 12 and put your own little tweaks on it and use that. It would be better than letting Arne Duncan and Obama's education department rule.
And influence them. So your Phyllis Schlafly report is available at eagleforum.org. I appreciate you giving us some time. We're going to keep telling the truth and helping people understand. Our show is called Homefront because we're here to strengthen the home. And we're about growing people bigger and shrinking government smaller. And I believe through education, we can help people find a better way. There just need to be us good folks speaking the truth, being a conscience for our government and for the legislators that are there. And I think you're wonderful, and I appreciate you joining us today. Is there any last word of encouragement you want to say to America?
Well, Eagle Forum has got a record of winning a lot of battles, and we invite you to join us. We have a great, we're a volunteer organization. We invite everybody listening to join us. We hope you will, and go on the website, eagleforum.org, and get my newsletter, the Phyllis Schlafly Report, which I think is now in about its 46th year. And you can get good reports on all the subjects that we're interested in.
Thanks, Phyllis. God bless you. This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.